You're listening to the Podcast Detroit Network. Visit www.podcastdetroit.com for more information.
Hello and welcome to Life Couch. I'm Sandra McNeil here with Judy Melanowski. She's a therapist and life coach. The idea behind this podcast is I met Judy because we were talking about all the recent high-profile suicides last year. And we were just talking about why people seem to be hurting so much. I mean, it's the 21st century. We should be happy. Life's kind of easy compared to how it was. And we just kind of want to talk about a lot of issues I think people are going through right now and sort of maybe offer help. Obviously, Judy, you know, you're not offering a private therapy session. These are general concepts that we're talking about as far as what's going on. So Judy was saying, let's do the first one on change, because to make anything happen, it starts with change. And why is it so hard to change?
Well, that's the age-old question of why do we resist change? And I think that's probably what we need to ask ourselves. Is change inevitable? And if it is inevitable, then why are we continually resisting the changes that we know that either we know we need to make or other people are telling us that we need to make? And the biggest block to change is what I call resistance, or what we call resistance. I haven't coined the term by any means. And I was speaking with a friend of mine just before, you know, this podcast, and she said, so what is it? What's the deal with resistance? And first, number one, resistance always occurs when change is present. And number two, and I think this is really important for people to hear, is that resistance occurs when you're going from a lower level of functioning to a higher level of functioning. So if you're experiencing resistance in your life, that's a good thing. And the minute that you embrace it, the minute that you say, oh my goodness, I'm feeling this because I'm moving from a lower level of functioning, physically, emotionally, mentally, spiritually, whatever the case may be, to a higher level of functioning.
And let's talk about that, because that's the neuroscience behind it, right? Absolutely. I was reading that our lives begin with, we learn by creating these neural pathways. And I read that the older you are, right, the more you've traveled that pathway, it's kind of like you've flattened down the grass and it's getting down to the dirt and you're ready there. And when you try to change that, your brain is what's resisting and working against you.
Absolutely. I like to use the example of, I know everybody's experienced this, it's like driving your car to work every day, or driving your car to a location that you go to consistently. Oftentimes you'll get to that location and you will not remember how you've gotten there, because your mind is literally on autopilot. That's what happens with these neural pathways. They become our autopilot. Now, that's a good thing, because it makes us more efficient. It makes us able to process things quicker. But when we're looking at dysfunctional behaviors and dysfunctional things that we have in our life, those are also kicking in at that time too. And that's where the resistance comes in, when we're moving from something that's been negative or dysfunctional into something that's really challenging us.
It's kind of interesting, because we look at other people and are baffled, right? I say, you just had a heart attack, why can't you diet? Or this relationship's so bad for you, why can't you leave? But then we're the same ourselves.
Absolutely.
When we try to make change.
I always say the devil we know is better than the devil we don't know. And even though I may be unhappy, I don't know necessarily what happiness would feel like. I don't know what's on the other side of that abyss. And so fear kicks in. And as soon as fear kicks in, it halts me from doing the things that I need to do, whether it's leaving a relationship, changing my diet, having a lifestyle change. Those are big things for people.
There is something to be said for not wanting to be surprised. And that comes up a lot.
Well,
you're maybe unhappy, but you know this level of unhappiness.
Absolutely. It's so funny. I'll ask people, you know, do you like surprises? And they'll always say, oh, yeah, I love surprises. And I'll say, you know, liar, liar, pants on fire. We like the surprises we want. We don't like the surprises we don't want. And so that's our comfort zone. You know, when we stay in that and we go, well, you know, I know what to expect. I know what to expect with this job. I know what to expect with this person. I know what to expect with this situation. And so I want to stay in that zone.
everything bad, I think really bad in my life has always been right out of the blue. So I guess it's common. It's kind of, I feel like when I worry about something, it's never as bad as I think.
It shouldn't be because worry doesn't do anything. One of the things that I've learned is only do those things that solve a problem, and worry never solves a problem.
But we feel like it gives us control. I know that's it doesn't logically make sense.
Oh, absolutely. I would say to, you know, my mother, looking back, I realize now that, you know, my mother had depression. Back when I was a kid, I didn't realize it. But she was a chronic worrier. And I would say to her, you know, Mom, why are you worrying? Everything you worry about never happens. And she would say, see? You know, so we have this delusion that starts to happen that reinforces. Because what I'm doing, it's kind of like when a child has magical thinking. Magical thinking is that we have this power that we don't have. And so we think that, in a sense, if we worry, our magical thinking is it's not going to happen. Or if it does happen, I'm prepared. And that's probably the greatest issue, is that we're not ever really prepared for what the things that are going to occur in our life, except that things happen. That's the only preparation that we're ever going to have.
And I don't know if you want to talk about different changes that people want to make. There are obviously people who absolutely have to change, whether they're maybe an addiction or about to lose their jobs. And then there are, you know, maybe others of us who just would like to look better or have a different job or whatever. So what is the hardest to change? And obviously, are different personalities easier, more adaptable to change than others?
I think change comes with, when it gets easier to change, in a sense, when we've gone through difficult times and we've come out the other end, and then we see, wow, that really was painful, but because I went through it, I'm a stronger person, I'm more aware, I'm happier, I'm more satisfied with life. I don't know if it's necessarily personality. I just think it's part of the human condition. There's resistance, again, that always shows up. And part of it is that we have to navigate through obstacles of change. And I look at the different obstacles of, you know, there's something wrong with me. That's why I can't change. I'm defective. And a lot of people have that sense of themselves. There's also the concern that when we change, it's going to adapt, or it's going to alter the status quo of our life. What are we going to have to leave behind? And so there's a grieving process that happens with change, positive or negative. Yeah. And I think that's what's so powerful.
Right.
You know, I work with a lot of teenagers, and currently I have quite a few clients that are seniors in high school. And I'm seeing it. I'm seeing this conflict that they're having between, oh my goodness, I'm graduating after 12 years of everything I've done. I'm so looking forward to it. Coupled with, oh my goodness, now what? You know,
I felt that. I thought I was the only one in high school.
I know. And we don't talk about it, right?
Right.
You know, we're supposed to be happy and we're supposed to be whatever, but they're grieving. You know, how is this going to affect their relationships? How is this going to affect the choices that they're going to make? Are they going away to school? Are they staying home? Do they need to get a job? How are people going to look at them now? Because we have different expectations of people as they age, as they grow, and as they develop.
And what I read, too, is because of these, you're moving away from these trodden paths in your brain, you have to engage the prefrontal cortex to change.
Right.
So you're constantly, it's taking all this energy and stress, and that it's very tiring. And if you're already tired, you're going to revert back to it. Like, your brain is doing this for you, right?
Absolutely.
Why is it working against us?
Well, you know, and I'll hear that. Clients will come into my office and they'll say, I'm so tired. And they're not necessarily physically tired. They're emotionally and mentally tired. And that's where personal self-care is so important. And what I mean by that is taking time for yourself, meditating, practicing mindfulness, exercising, all of the things that – it was so funny. I went to a symposium the other day, and they were talking about alternative treatments, right? We have this huge opiate addiction issue and different things. And they were saying, you know, meditation and massage and diet. And I'm going, those are considered alternatives, you know, and because I look at those as the most important things that you can do.
Right. Right. So let's talk about the first step then.
Okay.
And do you have to have a ton of motivation? Because like I say, some people don't, but they're being forced into it by life circumstance.
Absolutely.
Some people say that you change doesn't happen until you hit rock bottom. I don't know if that's true or not, but usually with addictive personalities.
Well, you know, I think it's very interesting because one of two dynamics have to be present. Either you need to have internal distress to move you towards change, or you have outward dysfunction. Many of us have not only inward distress, but we also have outward dysfunction too, right? We got both of them. But one of those have to be present. What's most concerning for me, though, is that when somebody comes in and they have a lot of outward dysfunction, oftentimes when that dysfunction, whether it's, an arrest or a divorce or some sort of loss, the further we move away from that, the less need we feel for change. So it's like the carrot and the stick. What motivates us? Am I motivated by the carrot or the stick? Well, pain is a huge stick, isn't it? But when I move away from that pain, oftentimes my motivation goes down.
Right.
Right? When I'm motivated by the carrot, I'm continually, and when I realize that I can continually move that forward, because progress of any time is what creates the internal happiness that we're looking for. So there either needs to be internal distress or external dysfunction. I would much rather there be internal distress before there's external dysfunction.
So say the beginning of the year, we had all these resolutions, or maybe even one.
Right.
Now we're, 5 months in. Where do we start if we want to change something?
Right now. All you got is right now.
Okay.
And that's probably when people, that to me is, it's one of the most powerful things that you can say to someone. And that's the hallmark of mindfulness and the movement we have now. I'm sure many of the people that are going to be listening to this podcast have heard of that word mindfulness. What does that mean? It really means paying attention. It really means coming back to your senses. You know, what am I hearing? What am I tasting? What am I touching, smelling? All of those things can pull you right back to the present moment. And when you come back to the present moment, that is the only moment you have. You know, we as human beings are delusional when we think we have a past and a present, a past and a future. We don't. We only have now. So you come back to the now.
And usually our minds are on what happened at work or, what I have to do tomorrow.
Absolutely.
I've tried too. I've noticed in trying to do it, like, is it called trance meditation? Or if you just stare at something for a moment, it does bring relief. And I don't know why, they call it a gazeless gaze in yoga, right? Where your focus kind of goes out.
Right.
Is that one way to do it?
It is one way. And there's many other ways. You know, come back to your breath. Just ask yourself, am I breathing? Because as soon as you ask yourself a question, am I breathing? See, the mind is doing one of two things at all times. It's either asking or answering a question. So when you keep asking it one particular question, am I breathing? It's going to say, yes, you're breathing. And so it's going to focus on the breath. Because oftentimes when we become anxious, when we become distracted, when we become up into our head thinking, we're not breathing. I hear it all the time. I hear people, they'll say, that's another reason we get so exhausted is because we're not taking in enough breath. We're not taking in enough oxygen. And so just the deep rhythmic breathing will help you come to the present moment.
I've read that. They say that you can't think of anything else when you're concentrating on your breath. But to be honest, my mind can do both things. So I don't think that's necessarily true.
Oh, yeah.
I was trying to do it now. I was listening to you and concentrating on my breath at the same time.
Yeah, it's called split thinking. Yeah, right? And we all have this monkey brain where we call yoga and we call meditation and we call all of these things a practice. And I think we call them a practice because we're never really going to get perfect at them. We're always in the process. One time we do it and it's just such a profound experience. And the next time we do it, we're thinking of grocery lists and all of the things that we need to do around the house. And so that's where training and discipline. And I know people hear that word discipline and they think to themselves, oh, that's such a hard word. But we have to differentiate between what's discipline and what's punishment. Oftentimes we will punish ourselves and shame ourselves into doing certain things differently. Case in fact, going on a diet or trying to lose weight. I see more people shaming themselves into trying to make a change rather than moving into this is going to give me more vitality. This is going to help me feel better about myself. This is going to increase my self-confidence and self-esteem. So that's where human beings with their limiting beliefs, because you asked, what's the first stage? The first stage is I know I need to change. Change right. occurs. Mm-hmm. The second stage is navigating the obstacles of change.
I know I've done a ton of diets, right? And to me, the most annoying thing when you start, depending on what diet you're on, you have to lay out your food and you have to remember that you're not eating the way you were. So it does take a – I can see what they mean by, you know, your prefrontal cortex is going because your kind of go-to, maybe, you know, I'm out and I'm just going to get a bagel. Oh, wait a minute. I can't have a bagel. So you sort of have to do all this planning ahead. But what I don't like about it is for the first week or so, it's on your mind all the time. This is what I can't eat. This is what I can't eat. This is what I can. What is this going to work? But then eventually you settle into that pattern where everything's just okay.
Right. And human beings love habits.
Yes.
You know, we all have them.
Right.
They're efficient. They help us get things done. We don't have to do a lot of thinking. But it takes time to establish a new habit. And I will tell people, you know, everything to me, in a sense, is learning. We are learning machines from the time that we're born. And so we have learned dysfunctional or self-destructive patterns of behavior, and it takes time to unlearn and replace those destructive patterns with new ones. It's not ever a quick fix, and that's where I think people, we love immediate gratification. That's why people like to alter their state of consciousness with alcohol and drugs. The reality
yes.
is they work, and they give us immediate gratification. But it's also a learned behavior, and that may be a whole different mindset when we start looking at dependency and addiction. What if it's a learned pattern? And then I change my brain structure through this continual pattern of behavior.
How much time? That's what we want to know, right, when you go into it. How long before it becomes easier?
Well, you know, there's the old adage, 21 days or any of those types of things. I think it really comes down to we got to take this one day at a time, 1 hour at a time, 1 minute at a time sometimes. Because, you know, when we make a decision consciously, talk about the prefrontal cortex, when we start to make that decision to change, resistance is going to come up. We always know that. So we have to be consciously aware of the resistance, engage in a behavior that moves us forward while we also know that emotionally we may not want to move. We may not, you know, I want that bagel because maybe it's
right.
not that I'm physically hungry, but I might be emotionally and psychologically hungry. You know, what if I had an argument with someone? What if I, you know, I'm stressed out, all of those different things. Most people don't eat the way they eat because they're physically hungry. They eat the way they eat because they're feeding some level of emotional need.
Right. And that'll be another podcast.
Right? I think so.
Talking through that.
I think so.
Do you want to go through the stages then? Because you said there are stages you go through when you make a change.
Absolutely. First stage of change is change needs to happen, or change is happening regardless of whether I want it to happen or not. The second stage would be navigating the obstacles. Like I said, resistance, all of those thoughts, all of the, even the external pressures that I may get. Because even though individuals in our life may say they want us to change, when we change ourselves, we are also going to change the status quo of every single thing in our life, whether it's our job, whether it's our relationships, whether it's you name it. You know, what if the change that I need to make is that I no longer want to be a people pleaser, and I decide that I'm going to start setting some healthy boundaries within my relationships? Well, I got to tell you, if you've been a people pleaser and you start setting boundaries in your relationships, you're not necessarily going to be making other people happy. So we got to navigate those obstacles, and we need to get support, and we need to get people in our lives that are going to help us with that. This third stage is integration. And integration really is that like, aha, like even though this is difficult for me to do, the benefits are outweighing the cost. See, it's economics.
Right.
As long as the benefits outweigh the cost, I'll stay in that status quo. But when the scales start to tip and the costs outweigh the benefits, that's when I know that I need to change. So we need to start tipping the scales towards change, that the benefits of change are outweighing the costs of staying the same. because that's when most people do change, is when the pain of staying the same is greater than the pain of change. And then the fourth stage is literally walking it out. And what I mean by that is integrating that in our life, having those crucial conversations where we're setting boundaries on people, cleaning out our pantry of all of the stuff that's in there that could sabotage
right.
our diet, right?
Yes.
The Oreo cookies we have in the back, all right. whatever, right? You know, having that conversation with our supervisor, our boss, of saying, you know what, I don't know whether or not this, you know, that I want to do this position anymore. Maybe I want to alter. Maybe I want to do something else. So it's all of those types of things. And then that integration motivates us, solidifies it, and helps us reinforce the next stage of change. But always understand that before change really happens, there's always a chaotic time. There's always stuff that starts to get pulled up.
I want to go back to one of the first things you talked about, which is other people.
Oh,
because
yeah.
When I've tried to set boundaries, mm-hmm. sometimes it's always going to come back. People are always going to try to put you back where they want you to be. And sometimes it does get exhausting. You just think, I've already been through all this. I thought I was having a great time. Now I'm feeling guilty again. And you have to go right back to that at the beginning. Well, but it does get easier when you've done it before, I guess. That's what you're saying.
Right. And I love, you know, when I hear, whether I've listened to so many other podcasts, and when I hear, you know, make your yeses, yes, true. You know, so when you say yes to somebody, they know that you're doing it from your heart, not doing it from some pseudo twisted sense of obligation. And that's where most of us really, you know, go off the mark. We're saying yes because we feel obligated, because if we don't say yes, we're feeling guilty, or we're in a state of fear that if I say no to you, our relationship is so tenuous and fragile that I'm afraid that I'm going to lose your love and your acceptance. And that is far more painful to me than doing something that I really don't want to do.
Abandonment issues. Right?
Absolutely. Abandonment and rejection. You know, when we talk about our archetypal wounds, it's shame, abandonment, and betrayal, right?
Yeah.
And so that's what we're always trying to avoid. But if I keep saying yes to you when I really want to say no, I really do a couple of different things. I prevent you and me from really examining our relationship and do we have an authentic, transparent, truly healthy relationship? And I'm not being true to myself. So I'm not being true to you, but I'm also not being true to me. And I'm also not allowing you, when you don't truly want to do something, that gives you the freedom of saying, nope, I don't really want to do that. What I see most people vacillate between, two sides, one coin, guilt or resentment. I don't know about you. I don't want my personal relationships to be driven by guilt, so you say yes to me, or resentment, you say yes to me when you really want to say no.
That is so true, by the way. We could do a whole podcast on boundaries.
Awesome.
Because I feel like people set them and then they think that you can't compromise. And, you know, I think they can be fluid, right? Sometimes you don't have to be a solid boundary. I'm never going to do anything that someone else wants to do.
Absolutely.
Because then you can't do things together.
Right. You know, there's things that I'll say, you know, yes, I'll do that with you. And then there's other ones that I'll say, no, I'm not so interested. It was so funny. I was at the lake with a friend of mine and her daughter, and we were having a great time. And her daughter said, Judy, you know, would you like to go to Cedar Point with us? And I went, no. And she goes, oh, come on. And I went, no, those days are done. And her mother goes, she's done. She's not. And it felt so good to say a clean, clear no without, you know, it was like, she'll have other people that go with her. She doesn't need me to go with her, but right. I felt like, all right, I could go and be miserable because there's no point in me doing that. I don't want to do that anymore.
No offense to Cedar Point.
No offense to Cedar Point, but you know,
get a new coaster this year.
Roller coasters are out of my bandwidth right now.
So what we're talking about though is this is all discomfort.
Yes,
and it's not making change sound very fun. I have to be honest, Judy. So let's deal with the first thing that you talked about, grief. And I know especially the people with addiction, and I've read a lot of times they have to leave everyone they know because these people have become unhealthy for them to be around. How do you deal with that Because in the hardest times, you're going through grief, and that is going to make you want to go back to the old behavior even more because it's how you cope with life.
Absolutely. And that's such a great point that you're making. Because oftentimes when we do have to make a significant change, we're not only leaving, whether it's a substance or a job or a relationship, we're leaving other things behind. So it's not just the primary loss. There's secondary losses. And Scott Peck talks about this in his book, Further Down the Road, Less Traveled. Excellent book if you ever get a chance. It's older. He says you have to replace, because the universe and the world does not contain a vacuum. And so you have to replace positive things with, while you're also eliminating the negative. And so when you look at that, that's why individuals, and that's probably one of the biggest things we need to address within the recovery field, is how do we have more inclusion? How do we have more just connection? Because if we're looking at something that's going on in this country, this society, we may be more connected than we've ever been with technology, but we're also the most disconnected. And we've got to find a way to, first off, change ourselves, you know, find out who we truly are. What is my identity? My identity is not my job. It's not my relationships. Those are functions of my life, but they're not who I am. So first of all, we have to find out who we are. The next thing we need to do is we need to connect with other people, with who they are. And when somebody comes around that you have a deep affinity with, you know that you're not just connecting on a psychological, you're connecting on a spiritual and mental, all of those levels, correct?
Right.
And so then
I guess that's why they have a sponsor. It makes sense.
Absolutely. And getting to support groups and doing all of these things. And then you've got to get beyond yourself and say, and this is the hallmark. If we look at true recovery of anything, it's how do I pay this forward? How do I go into service? How do I now, me, make a difference in the world? Because that's the only way that you truly have recovery, is when you get out of yourself and you start putting it out there.
It's interesting because I'm hearing you say something different than I would think. I would think you're going through grief, so you should be in your mind experiencing that and getting over it. But you're saying you need to do all that at the same time, which sounds like it would be easier.
Yes. Well, and I don't know about you, but my mind oftentimes is not the best place for me to be.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Right. I can talk myself into or out of really, it can go to a very, very dark place. And oftentimes it's in the connection with other people that if I can say to someone, man, I've been having some really dark thoughts. The soon as I am able to bring it out and talk about it and get it out of my head and hear the feedback from another person, whether that other person just says something as simple as, you know what? I have those thoughts too. How deep is that connection? I have those thoughts too. And then we can go, oh, I'm not out here all by myself. I'm not a person on an island.
I've been in the process of sharing a lot of things, and it shocks me how often people say that, and it does make me feel a lot better.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely.
Because we look at other people and we think they always have it made, right?
Oh, they look good from the curb, don't they?
Or on Instagram.
I know. That's probably one of the tricks of social media, is that it presents somewhat of a false kind of image of us sometimes. You know, you see people having great times, but you're not really, you got to know that everybody's got stuff. Everybody's got something.
Right. So we're dealing with discomfort. The first one was from grief. And I just want to point this out too. I think a lot of times people with addiction, sometimes they have to leave their own family members if it's in the family. And that has to be just so difficult.
Well, and there's the grief of losing the substance.
Yeah. Well,
whatever it is. I mean, you were talking about going on a diet. There's a grief and loss when we have to look at, well, what am I ever going to be able to have chocolate cake?
Oh, yes.
Right? There's a grief and loss with food. And the difference between food and those types of things is that we still have to have a relationship with it.
Yes.
Got it?
Right.
You know, abstinence doesn't work when it's on a diet. We all know that. But when we're talking about substances, there's been a relationship between the person and the substance. That substance has done something for them. And so to say you're never going to have a craving, or you're never going to have the desire to use, or you're never going to have the longing, is really setting them up for feeling a great deal of guilt and shame when those emotional states come up.
Right. But I lost my train of thought here. There's another thing that happens. Yeah, we're grieving that substance, but people think if we give into it, we are lacking discipline, I guess. I think that attitude is still out there.
I'm not talking about necessarily giving into it. I'm talking about identifying it and understanding that the thoughts and the emotions that you have about going through the change are normal.
Right.
It's about normalizing. What you're feeling is normal. What you're thinking, you know what? It's normal to have thoughts. Thoughts just come. We can be having the best day in the whole world and a negative thought will pop up in our mind. It's not that we're not going to have negative thinking. It's that where we get in trouble is when we attach to a thought, and we have that thought leads to another negative thought, leads to another negative thought, leads to another negative thought, and I'm down the rabbit hole.
When you're making a major change, how much of your day is taking up with being off autopilot? We can't do that all day, right?
No. I think it's really important to understand that change happens incrementally. Most people are not able to make a sweeping change. There's way too many consequences that happen when we do that. And it doesn't necessarily stick. Change happens day by day, bit by bit, moment by moment. And that will build a foundation that's going to last much longer. It's kind of, you know, like when people will say to me sometimes, well, you know what, I'm just going to sell everything, quit my job, and move to California.
What a dream.
Absolutely. The trouble is—
The wine country.
Yeah. You take yourself wherever you go.
Right.
You know, so you may change your circumstances, but it's not necessarily going to change you. You'll create the same dysfunction wherever you go. Geographical relocation does not necessarily mean health.
So I guess what I'm trying to say, though, is you're talking about a lot of time feeling discomfort and being exhausted, and how do we cope with that?
That's where self-care kicks in. That's where doing the things that you need to do in order to recharge your batteries.
So should you come up with a list for that when you're too exhausted that you say, I remember this makes me feel better, I should go for a walk or ride my bike?
Go for a walk, do 20 minutes of meditation, do some deep breathing, take a class. You know, there's certain things that we know. So the ironic thing is we know that, you know, going to the gym is going to make us feel better, but we go through all of this resistance before going to the gym. I don't know about you, but I have had long-term conversations in my head about, am I going, am I not going, am I going, am I not going, right? But once I get there, I feel so much better. And that's the things that we have to keep reminding ourselves. You know, I know that if I sit and just have some alone time to recharge my batteries, that's going to make me feel better sometimes. I've got to have kind of like I have to have a lot of tools in my toolbox in order to figure out what may work at the time.
I want to point out, too, that, you know, when you're going through depression, that makes all of that so much harder.
Oh, absolutely.
So that's another element, something we can talk about sometime. But I think, you know, just getting off the couch is that conversation in your head is really loud.
Yes. And there's oftentimes when I have clients who have deep depression, it's one thing. Do one thing. Get out of bed and make your bed. Do the dishes. You know, take a walk. Wash your face. Take a shower. I know these things sound kind of ludicrous but when you're in a deep funk, sometimes it's the most that you can do is to get out of bed and take a shower. And we know that those things are going to make us feel better. And then you build on that from there.
That's another podcast. Yes. Depression is so prevalent right now.
Absolutely.
What I was reading is that you're going to have a lot of fight or flight when you're changing, the anxiety.
Yeah, that can happen because our fight or flight, now that we are not in a world where we have lions at the door or bears coming at us, most of our fight or flight is kicked in because of what we call maladaptive thinking. And so the maladaptive thinking could be all of the cognitive distortions, you know, the all or nothing thinking, everything is black and white, the fortune telling, the yeah buts or the what ifs, all of those things. Well, what if I change? What's going to happen? And so all of those things, see, because we can have anxiety can either be from the top down, from our thinking down, which triggers off our adrenals and our fight or flight or our freeze.
Right.
Or we can have it from the bottom up.
What does that mean?
That means our body can trigger us to go into what we call a panic attack. So say I haven't eaten all day and it's around 3 o'clock in the afternoon and I have a drop in my blood sugar. I can go into literally a confused state because now I've triggered off my mind and my brain to behave differently. If I have my heart rate kicks in a little bit, I can trigger off an anxiety attack. If I'm not breathing correctly and my breathing becomes shallow, it could trigger off those things. So it's all, you know, where is it coming from? Am I taking care of myself biologically and am I taking care of myself psychologically?
For those of us who have insomnia, I feel like it's possibly, I guess, things that happen during the day and you don't pay attention to it. Mm-hmm. And then at night, you feel all these chemicals, whether it's adrenaline or cortisol, and you can't sleep and you sort of don't know why because you're lying in bed. There's nothing wrong.
Mm-hmm. but it's subconscious.
Right.
If we think about our psyche, our unconscious is about 80 to 80% and our consciousness is about 18 to 12%, 20%, right? So our subconscious, our unconscious mind is the big dog. It's what's it's running us all the time. So when we try to fall asleep, because most of us, for one thing, don't practice really good sleep hygiene, and we could do a whole podcast on what do you need to do before you go to bed.
Yes.
We don't practice that, and so we're still wired. We're still wired from the day.
Yes.
And we're not doing the things we need to slowly bring us down. Whether that's, you know, making sure we don't have light, whether I have a lot of clients that are so grateful because they have suffered with insomnia. And the one thing I tell them to do is go onto a meditational app and go onto the, just listen to the 20 minute sleep. There's millions of them out there that talk about that'll take you through falling asleep. What's great about it, it shuts off after you fall, you know, after 20 minutes. Most of the time, people are not able to remember the meditation shutting off. They've already been asleep. And so what I love about guided meditations is that it gives us something to focus on. It gives us something to pay attention to.
It's hard to pay attention when you're in the middle of anxiety.
Absolutely.
Though. I find meditation almost impossible, almost annoying because you're getting anxiety about not being able to meditate.
Again, there's the resistance. That annoyance is the because your mind's going, this is really good for me. And the other part of your mind's going, but I don't want it to be good for me. I want to be in my state of chaos,
right?
Again, like I said earlier, practice. It's practice, 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 practice.
I feel like some people, when you mention working out and meditation, say, oh, yeah, you know, those good things. But they want to do their go-tos, which is possibly a glass of wine for those who aren't alcoholics or now marijuana is legal mm-hmm. in Michigan. Can you use that to ease the stress in moderation, or is that not work at all?
Well, my biggest concern is, again, if it's learning and I'm stressed and I have a glass of wine or I do this, my brain is now saying, wow, the next time you feel like this, this is going to be your go-to. It's not really addressing the cause of why you're feeling the way you're feeling.
I see what you're saying.
It's medicating. And you know,
that's why I feel so good.
I know. And believe me, I'm not here to say that I haven't enjoyed quite a few glasses of wine in my time. And it does make you feel better. It's, you know, why do we call after work happy hour? Because it shifts it. But I also know that that's where it could become a bad habit. And then it could become a dependency, not necessarily an addiction. But it becomes a dependency where it becomes your go-to.
So dependency means a glass or two or three every night, and addiction means I have to have the whole box and I'm going to be late for work the next day, basically.
Well, an addiction has so many other aspects to it. You know, what other things in my life am I now trading off so that I can engage in this? How is it controlling my life? You know, a dependency is that I need it because it, but an addiction, it's, you've crossed the line into the substance, the behavior, or whatever it is, the situation that was giving me relief from pain is now causing pain.
I'd like to talk about motivation because that's probably the one thing we're missing. Sometimes it's really hard to be motivated.
Mm-hmm.
And then we talked about the depression will increase that. But, you know, we've had an awful lot of rainy, cloudy weather that brings that on, at least in Maine. You don't want to go out.
Absolutely. And believe me, I am so in alignment with you. Every day that I look at the weather, I keep thinking,
it has been horrible here in Michigan.
When are we going to see some sunshine? Because we know what, you know, multiple days of gray and rain affect us. You know, we've had seasonal affective disorder, and I think to myself, our seasonal affective disorder is now, you know, stretched out into April and May.
I know. It's terrible.
It is. It's been really difficult. And oftentimes we have to, that's where we have to find that internal, like, I got to push myself. I've got to do it whether or not I like it. And that self-discipline is the hardest thing to develop because that's really shows us how much we love ourselves is how self-disciplined we are. And not all the time do we have the discipline to be disciplined.
What about having someone on standby to sort of give you that kick in the backside?
You bet. That's why I love, you know, my best workouts have always been with a workout partner. That's why I now go to a class where I have to, you know, book an actual slot in the class. And I know that there's going to be people there that are going to hold me accountable. Many times whenever we're starting something new, having a coach or an accountability partner. And, you know, we call this life coach. So the reality is that having a life coach, somebody that's going to say, you know what, let's set some goals and let's break down those goals to steps. And then we break down those steps to tasks so that I can have those bite-sized, you know, little things that I do, that's what keeps us motivated.
Right. When you, early on in the podcast, you talked about magical thinking, and I immediately was thinking about visualization boards. I have found in the past that I'm surprised how much they work, even though I don't think I'm even looking at them. One day I made one and had forgotten about it, and I realized months later, maybe a year later, that I had pretty much done everything on the board.
Absolutely.
So that is that magical thinking, or how does that work? And that seems like that would be a really big boost in change.
Well, magical thinking and visualization and imagery are kind of two different things. Because imagery is putting, you know, bringing the picture forward in our mind of what we would like to create. See, human beings think in pictures, don't we? If I say to you,
I do, yeah.
Right. If I say to you, refrigerator, do you think of the word refrigerator or do you think of your refrigerator in your kitchen?
Yeah, I'm seeing it right now.
Absolutely. So we think in pictures. That's why dream boards are so powerful. And so when we put a dream board together, what we're really doing is we're setting an intention and we're being disciplined in setting that intention. So I want a different job or I want a great relationship. I'm, you know, the magical thinking would come in of I want a great relationship and I want that great relationship with Matthew McConaughey. All right. Now that's magical thinking, right? Got it. But I want my great relationship. So that's more of setting the intention. That's the visualization. So when you can visualize, because our mind doesn't know the difference between what we visualize and image in it and what's really going on in the world.
Really?
Yeah, it's amazing. That's why, you know, when you utilize it, that's what's so wonderful about children. You know, their imaginations are so vivid that they are literally living it in their head. That's why they can make a castle out of two blankets and a couple of chairs in the kitchen. They're there. And if you think about it, what difference does it make? If I can move into a state of happiness with my thoughts and really find that image, I'm setting my creation in motion. So even if it's not here yet, I'm still in a great state of mind. I'm still in a great place. And when I'm in that place, I'm better able to make decisions. I'm better able to be open to opportunities. Goethe said, when you make a decision to change and you really hold on to it, the universe will align itself to bring the right opportunities, people, and situations in order to support you. And I think that's what's so powerful about our minds.
So the board should have maybe one thing on it at a time or not necessarily?
Oh, not necessarily.
Okay.
Bring it all in. Bring it all in.
Because you're talking about imagination and daydreams, which I personally love, but that's opposed to living in the present. But in yoga, we're supposed to be present, but I'm telling you, if it's really hard, I like my little daydreams.
That's
right. I'll rethink of a passage in a book, and I think this is not what I'm supposed to be doing, but I personally like it.
Well, and does it give you pleasure? Does it give you a relief?
Yes.
Absolutely. That's why we like going to movies. That's why there's certain shows that I watch on TV. I mean, we go into – that's why I love to read. You know, we need to be able to understand that it only becomes a problem if that's all I'm doing. If all I'm doing is sitting around daydreaming and imaging and all of those different things and I'm not engaging in the world, then it becomes dysfunctional. But if I do it as a coping skill – if I say I'm going to lay here and meditate for 20 minutes and just meditate on beauty and what I want and Tuscany, I don't know what it is, right?
I'm there. Maybe
we
should do a podcast in Tuscany.
I'm with you. Absolutely. It was just so funny. I was watching a movie and it was in Tuscany and I went, you know what? I'm going. It was so beautiful. And so that's, you know, if it gives you pleasure, if it gives you that sense of endorphins popping in your brain, then it also will move you and motivate you. You wanted to talk about motivation. It'll move you because that's really what motivation does. It moves us to do things.
You're making me think, though, that maybe throughout the day you can have your daydream imagining yourself where you want to be, and then sometimes things will come up, right? Reasons we think we shouldn't be there, we'll never make it, or we don't deserve it, or whatever. If we can do it without that.
Absolutely.
So what's the process? Why does that work your brain when it sees you there? It's starting to make changes automatically or what?
Yeah, it's starting to put it – it's because it's energy. Everything is energy. And so my thoughts have an energy to them. So if I meditate on positive thinking, if I meditate on what I want instead of what I don't want – see, this is what happens with most people.
You're saying like a daydream, you're calling that meditation?
Absolutely.
Oh, okay.
Right. Because I've gone through certain meditations that will take me on a trip. And then it's kicking in my endorphins, it's kicking in my dopamine, it's kicking in all of those different neurochemicals that I need in order to create, going back full circle, to the neural pathways that you were talking about. And so when I do that and I change my state, I'm changing my state of being. What I am now doing is I'm saying I'm ready to receive all of the good things that are out there. Because the only thing that gets in the way are our limiting beliefs. I hear this all the time. People spend more time focusing on the how rather than the what and the why. The how is the business of the universe. And I know that sounds, and the how often shows up much differently than you ever could imagine. All of a sudden, you make this decision in your mind and you meditated on it and you've imaged it and that you wanted to create a podcast.
Right.
And you didn't know how that was going to happen. And then you meet somebody that you have an affinity for and you guys start to talk. And then all of a sudden, you're sitting in a studio having a podcast.
That's true. That is so true. I feel like we're getting to the good stuff. This is making me feel good about imagining things. So you're just making me think that shame is probably in the way a lot.
Oh, yeah.
And when I think about imagining things, that does, I think, especially for women, you do come up and think, yeah, but my friend doesn't have that. And if I do that, then she's going to be upset and that's not fair. And there are these negative
limiting beliefs.
Right. I don't know if those are neural pathways, but they probably are, right? That's something we're taught as children.
Absolutely. And, you know, we talk about in psychology the ego. And there's a wonderful book by Michael Singer called The Untethered Soul. And in it, he talks about the battle between the true self, who we truly are, and the ego. And the ego is the lie. It's the lie that we tell ourselves. It's the negative thinking that we have about ourselves. Because what we say to ourselves, Sandra, is far worse than what anybody would say to us. You know, that's the deepest level of shame. See, we were shamed, and I believe wholeheartedly that we've all been shamed on some level at some point in time.
Right.
And then we, you know, it's kind of like trauma. We, people who go through trauma, if they go through it and it goes unresolved, they then start engaging in behaviors that re-traumatizes themselves. They become their own perpetrator of the trauma.
Why is that?
It's because that's how we identify ourselves. If I've been shamed, then I must be defective. And if I'm defective, then I'm going to do things that are going to support that belief system I have that gives me evidence of what I'm believing is true, whether and is not discounting the lie of what that's being perpetrated on me.
So that's all autopilot. Those are neural pathways that go early.
That's the unconscious.
Because I feel like, you know, I think we've all pointed out things to our girlfriends. Why are you choosing these people? This is a pattern, but people don't realize that and will tell you, I have a great opinion of myself. I'm not that way. But they don't realize that there are pathways that are doing that thinking for them.
Not only the, you know, that's what's so interesting about the brain. You know, we have the brain and the mind. And so they work connected.
What's the difference?
Well, good. That's the age old question, right?
I don't know.
Because the brain is the physical structure.
Okay.
The mind is it's kind of like the hard drive and then the operating system, right? The mind is that thing that it's non-tangible. And so what we can do is understand that the brain is impacting the mind and the mind is impacting the brain. They're connecting. So I have certain neural pathways. I have certain brain structures, whether it's my limbic system, my prefrontal cortex, all of those types of things. That is there.
So the mind is the energy of your thoughts? Is that energy. What you're saying?
Yes, it's the energy. It's that thing that I can rewire my brain, my physical structure, with this energy that I have, my thoughts, my emotional states, all of those types of things.
And the ego basically sounds like you're saying is just judgment.
Yes.
It's comparing yourself to someone else, whether positively or negatively.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if we want to wrap up here, the pathway forward, vision board. I like this one.
It seems easier. Yes.
Working out. Okay, we'll do that.
Okay. Go for a walk. Yeah. Go for a walk. That's all I tell people.
That works for me because nature for me is just, it just really works. And unless it's like it is today.
But. Well, there was just a study that said spending 20 minutes outside in nature reduces anxiety significantly.
Without your phone, though, right?
Without your phone. Unplug.
Anything else you want to add, though, to help people get started with the motivation thing?
I think, you know, if you can commit to every day doing one thing that makes you feel good about yourself and just commit to one thing. If you feel like doing more than one thing, great, but commit to that one thing.
That makes you feel good about yourself.
Yeah. Meditating, walking, not eating a whole chocolate cake, drinking water, just simple things.
I don't know why.
Having a smile.
I do not like drinking water. That's silly.
Putting a smile on your face. That's really, it's amazing. Saying hi to somebody.
Thanks for listening. And thanks for listening to Life Couch. We will have more to come.
Sounds great.